magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host, Warwick Schiller, and if you've listened to quite a few of the podcasts, you would have heard me talk about a trip that my son and I went on to Mongolia about a year and a half ago to ride camels across the Gobi Desert. Well, that trip was organized by a friend of mine from New Zealand named Chloe Phillips Harris. And Chloe Phillips Harris' business card says, horsewoman, journalist, adventurer. And I don't know how to sum her up any other way, but those three things. But it's my great pleasure this episode of the podcast to have Chloe join us and learn more about her amazing life. Chloe Phillips Harris, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be here.
You know, I was always amazed at your business card that says Chloe Phillips Harris, journalist, horsewoman, adventurer. Like, that's quite the moniker to carry around.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah, a little bit less adventures this last year, but yes.
You've had just a life full of adventures. I mean, I think it's a big ask, a big call to put adventurer on your business card, unless you are a true adventurer and you like live up to that. So, like, you know, I think a lot of people would look silly having that in their business card, but you, it's like, hell yeah, and more. What else could you add to that?
Thanks. Yeah, I think when I first put it on the business card, I was like, well, I can't think of anything else to say. Do I just say that I like ride in different parts of the world on different animals, or like what's a good description? So it kind of became adventurer because I couldn't think of anything else to put. But yeah, these days it kind of feels like it's a legit term to use. I don't know what else I can add to that.
Well, you know, people from other parts of the world won't get this, but Australia and New Zealand will get this. Having that on a business card for most people would just sound like a bit of a wank.
Yeah.
But for you, it's not. It's like, what else? I mean, like I said, what else can you say? So, I don't know. We've only got 2 hours for this podcast. We usually don't go over 2 hours. And so I don't think we can fit your life into 2 hours because it's just amazing. So we're going to have to keep it to like the highlights, and maybe let's start in Mongolia, because that's, you know, Tyler and I did a podcast on the Gobi Cold Camel Expedition, and you were a big part of organizing that. So how about we start with, so you first went to Mongolia to do the Mongol Derby.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2013, I rode the Mongol Derby and just loved it instantly. Fell in love with the country, the horses, the open spaces, the people, everything.
For people who may not be familiar with it, do you want to give us a bit of an outline on the Mongol Derby itself?
Yeah, so the Mongol Derby is a 1,000-kilometer horse race across Mongolia. It's billed as the toughest horse race in the world, and having been involved with it now for a long time, I would say it definitely lives up to that title. So
is it the longest as well?
It's the longest, yep, the longest and toughest. There's pretty much nothing else like it anywhere in the world. And so basically it's a multi-day, multi-stage race for 1,000 kilometres, and you change horses. When I did it, you changed horses every 40 kilometres. Now I think you change horses about every 30 to 35 kilometres, and you've got a 5 kg saddlebag and backpack combined, and that's your gear for the entire race. And you cross the country, get to a new horse station, get your horse vetted, make sure it passes another vet station, vet check, get on the next horse and ride out again for as long as it takes you to do 1,000 kilometers. And I just loved it. It's just, to me, like, you know, it was definitely tougher than anything I thought I would ever do, and tougher than I ever imagined it being. But I just loved being on those horses. They're just so wild still, so fast, so kind of independent. And I think the fact that there is a race like that in this world that tests horsemanship as well as kind of a bit of common sense outdoor survival skills and a whole lot of other things is just phenomenal. Yeah, I loved it. I rode it in 2013 and then was kind of involved with the race. Probably got on a horse and rode most of it. Two more times after that, filming, and was involved in kind of the refereeing and the blood wagon and the rescue side of it as part of the crew for 6 years, as well as riding it in 2013.
For our American listeners, it's 1,000 kilometers. That's about 600 miles, and you get a 5 kilo pack, and there's 2.2 pounds to a kilo, so you can carry about 10 or 12 pounds on you. That's about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
What is there an entry fee for the race?
Yeah. It was basically my entire life savings back then, and I think it's even more now. I think it's about $15,000 US now. But I remember by the time I got over there, I think it was about, you know, including plane tickets and things like that, it was about 20,000 New Zealand for me back in 2013. And I remember it being like a really big decision, you know, like I'd saved all this money. It had taken me years to save all this money, and deciding whether to use all those savings on a horse race or use them to kind of, you know, potentially put down a house deposit or invest in the horses or something was a really big call. And having done the Derby, I would never regret a cent I spent on it. I think it was the best money I've ever spent, and it just was such a life-changing event. It comes with a price tag, but I think for me it was worth everything.
That's where the adventure bit on your business card comes in. Think about this. It's $15,000 US to enter, and when you win, if you win, after this grueling 1,000 kilometers on a half-wild horse across the steppe of Mongolia, what do you win?
Oh, well, as you cross the finish line, you get a bowl of IRAG, which is fermented alcoholic horse milk. And you get that if you are the first person across the line or the last person across the line. And that's about it. There's no prize money. You raise money for your chosen charity as well as Cool Earth while you're doing the race. But yeah, there's no prize money incentive, nothing like that. You might get a trophy if you win, but you know, that depends year to year. So I think there's two categories of people who go and do this kind of race. And for me, I wanted to just see what I could do. I really wanted to test myself. And then I guess there is the other people who kind of do it, they think for the, I guess, the fame and glory, or yeah, the news articles that come afterwards, or you know, to say they won or completed the world's toughest horse race. But yeah, I think for a lot of people who go, it's definitely not an incentive on what you win, because there is nothing. It's just to kind of test yourself. I guess some people go and climb Everest or climb a mountain, and others of us go and ride 1,000 kilometers.
Wow. So tell us about your experience with it, because you know, I've read the whole story. So Chloe has written a book called Fearless, which I think is just an absolutely great title for a book about your life. Did you come up with that title before we get too far in the Mongol Derby? But did you come up with that title for the book?
No, I wish I could say that I did, but no, I didn't. I wrote the whole book, and then you know, it was getting closer and closer to publish time, and talking with the editor, and we kind of bounced a few ideas around, and that was actually his idea, and the only one that kind of stuck was Fearless.
You know, knowing you, I just can't see you going, yeah, I'm going to write a book, it's about me, and I'm going to call it Fearless.
Yeah, no, definitely. It didn't come naturally, coming up with, I guess, that title and that kind of being like, oh, I'll write a book about myself. I think if it would have been up to me, I would have written, you know, a book about one of my favorite horses or something. And, right. You know, didn't, yeah, but I guess the opportunity came up, and with a bit of encouragement, it all came together.
Yeah, fascinating book. If anybody wants to read that one, it's, yeah, it's fascinating. But I've read the book, and so I know the story of your participation in the Mongol derby. So do you want to, let's talk about it a bit, because there's some stuff.
Some stuff went down, yeah.
Stuff went down.
Well, I guess, like, I mean, I signed up for it wanting to push myself to the limit. Like, that is the mindset that I went into this race, you know, prepared for. I'd worked with wild horses. I'd done a lot of eventing. I just, you know, like, I guess I wanted to see what I really was capable of, and I knew this was going to be tough. And I remember I talked to another New Zealand rider who'd done it a few years before me, and I went and met him for coffee, and I said, you know, like, you know, what do you think about the race? And he said, oh, well, the Mongol Derby will break you. And I was like, will not break me. What are you talking about? You know, and I remember thinking and kind of rolling my eyes to myself and thinking, oh, no, it won't break me. But, yeah, the Mongol Derby pushes everyone past their limit in some form or another. And I think while the good parts are so incredibly amazing, you know, getting on good horses, I rode one incredible horse. It was just phenomenal, and it just sticks in my mind. I got on this racehorse and been a really successful racehorse over in Mongolia, and it just galloped for 40 kilometres. Like, I just sat up there, and it was so light off the rein. It was just so sensitive. It was so beautifully trained, and it was so fit. And it just galloped 40 kilometres. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, this is horse riding. This is the most amazing thing I could ever imagine. And then, you know, 500 metres before I saw the vet station, I brought it down to a walk. It walked in, and it passed its vet check instantly. Like, its heart rate was below 65. And, you know, it probably took me, oh, I don't know, 5 minutes of walking from when I saw the vet station to when I got there, and it passed the vet check. And I just remember that just blowing my mind, the level of fitness and how incredible these horses were. So there's these amazing moments like this on the Derby. And then there are the other parts that are not so good. And I think, you know, like, if you're going out to do a challenge like that, you kind of have in your mind what you think the low points will be. But when you get to those low points, they can be so much worse than you ever imagined they could be. And I think you realize how hard it is to get through those low points, and how much more you kind of are capable of. Where you think your limit is, I can guarantee your limit is a lot further or higher, or whatever, however you want to say it, than you think. For my year in particular, we had a gastro bug going through our field at start camp. And I remember being in the gear.
You had a what?
Guys,
sorry?
A gastro bug through like the whole
okay,
field.
Hang on, let's talk about that for that's a very Australian New Zealand term. A gastro bug would mean a bad case of diarrhea is going through everybody.
vomiting and diarrhea.
Vomiting and diarrhea, yes. Very, very, very bad stomach bug, yes.
Yeah, and so this being the Derby and in Mongolia, you know, like, I was okay at start. There was a handful of people sick there. But, you know, you're in an environment that can get really, really, really hot. Like, dehydration is an issue at the best of times, and it can get really, really cold at night. So, you know, looking after yourself is a challenge. Plus, you're riding, like, I think I was riding about 120 to 160 kilometres a day as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's challenging. And then we got this bug that went through the fields, and it laid out some of the medics as well. So at some points, our medics were on IVs. I didn't know this. The other thing about the Derby is when you're riding it, you have no idea what's going on outside of your little bubble, your race. So I had no idea other people were sick. I had no idea the medics were sick, anything like that. But at one point, I did get really, really ill when I was riding. And, you know, to the point where you're kind of like hallucinating and you're losing the edges of your vision. And again, what I didn't know is that there was probably a big gap in the field behind me at this stage. But I kind of, you know, thought the next riders behind me were just behind the horizon, you know, hot on my heels. So I just kind of kept riding until, you know, like, I thought I was going to fall off the horse, and then got off and sat on the ground for a little while. And yeah, it was just in a really, really bad way. But yeah, made it through that day, made it through the gastro bug, survived that.
Let's just stop there for a second. You know, because you're so flippant about this. Yeah, I made it through the gastro bug. you know what? That is not much fun when you're sitting on the couch.
No.
Let alone riding a horse, a half-wild Mongolian horse across the Mongolian plains at a bit of a gallop. You know, when we did Tyler and I did the podcast about the Gobi Cold Camel trip.
Yeah.
You know, Tyler had one day where he, you know, you guys had told us before we went out there, don't poop too much, don't poop too little. There's not a lot of water to drink, so, you know, like take some laxatives if you have to. Well, Tyler overdid the laxatives and spent a whole day trying not to poop his deal while bouncing on the back of a camel and having a stomach ache all day bouncing on a camel. And later on in the trip, I got constipated and every camel footstep felt like a punch in the guts. So I can't, and we're just going slow. I cannot imagine cantering or galloping, you know, with that going on. I mean, every stride has got to go right through your body sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. I can laugh about it now because a few years have passed, but it was pretty bad then. I remember you'd be vomiting off the side of your galloping horse. And I remember my triumph being was I didn't vomit on myself. But yeah, you're still throwing up off the side of your horse at a gallop. And the horses, I mean, there's some brilliantly trained horses that I rode and there's some that are dubiously trained or even broken in, or maybe the last time they were ridden was, you know, that morning right before you got on them, or maybe not even then. So yeah, it was hideous. I was riding with one girl when I got sick and she was really, really great. And I'm here throwing up off the side of the horse and she's got a camera, she's got a GoPro and she's like, I missed it. Just do it again. Just throw up again. She's trying to record this on the camera. I'm just trying to stay alive. And then she actually misses me vomiting off the horse. So she's trying to get me to do it again. It was just, in hindsight, hilarious situation at the time. You were just trying to survive it.
Where was she from?
I ended up, she actually went on to win it. And she was great. We were kind of in the lead at the time. And I got the gastro bug and she was like, oh, well, I'll stay with you. And I was like, no, you go. Lara Pryor Palmer.
Where is she from?
Yeah. UK.
Really? You know, doing things like that, it's not just the adventure you have, and what you're doing.
Yeah.
But it's the other, the other people you meet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who were brave, crazy, whatever, enough.
Yeah.
To do the same thing. I mean, that's got to be pretty cool.
I think it's awesome.
The Gobi Cold Camel Trip thing, just driving out to the desert in the van, talking to everybody else that was along on the ride. It's like, holy cow, these are some pretty cool people.
Yeah, I think that's what I've always loved about this kind of stuff as well is the other people who are, interested in this. They generally have a pretty cool story, and even if you wouldn't, come across them in your daily life, there's something you've got in common that's brought you out to these places, to these kind of edges, and I think it's amazing. And I think I always felt that about the Mongo Derby was, even the crew, we're all there because we've got a shared passion, even if we're from all over the world. It was just really neat to be around people like that, because obviously in everyday life, if I tell people that I go and work in Mongolia for part of the year, most people just don't even know what to say. They're like, oh, well, that's nice. And, kind of go off to Google search where Mongolia is.
Yeah. So, okay. So you've survived the stomach bug.
Yeah.
So that's not the, because in the book you tell the story about how you almost died. That's not the almost dying bit, is it?
No. So I ended up getting an IV from the medics at 1 a.m. with the stomach bug, and the IV makes you feel much better. The gastro bug had passed, and this next morning, I'd caught up to these riders in front of me. And I just couldn't bear the thought. I still felt pretty bad, and I just couldn't bear the thought of them riding off and me just sitting or lying on the ground, you know, not giving chase. So I talked to the herders via the vet's translator and been like, look, I'm pretty weak. I can't like kick a horse along, but if you've got one that'll run, I'll just get my body back on a horse and keep going, and I'll ride out the same time as he. Like in my mind, that was like the logical kind of like, you know, plan for the next day. And like the medic's like, yeah, you're feeling better, right? You're feeling better. You know, like, you can't go on if you're not feeling better. I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling better. Lying through my teeth, not feeling that much better. Just, you know, I think nothing left to vomit up at this point. And so anyway, the herders is the picket line, which all the horses are on. And there's this tiny little pony, and they're like, oh, it's got quite a hard mouth, but it does go. So I'm like, fine. I've packed up my stuff. I get on the pony, smallest pony I've ridden in Mongolia, and it just bolts. It like bolts proper. And I just don't have anything left in me to fight it at this point. I'm like, you know what? I'll just let it run itself out. It's kind of not going the complete wrong way, but it's definitely not going in the right direction either. It's kind of going like askew. So it goes for like a good like 20 kilometer bolt, and the
just
saddle,
a short 20 kilometer bolt.
Yeah, and like I didn't realize at this point, but my tracker, so all the competitors in the race have a tracker, and at this point my tracker has like been torn out of its casing and gone flying off, as well as like a few bits and pieces. Obviously I wasn't in a great state that day when I was packing. Like I just stuffed everything in and been like, right, I'm gonna get on this horse and go. Anyway, so this horse is bolting, the tracker's gone, I don't know about this at this point. The saddle is like in front of its wither because this pony is so tiny and it just, you know, built like that way, and it's bolting across this swampland. So it's like moguls of hard land mixed up with like just swampy terrain that I think any of our Western horses would be floundering and stuck within 5 minutes. But this pony is going at like as fast as it can go and having no problem. And then, some wild dogs turned up and I saw them in the distance and I'm like, oh no, like, oh God, I'm really not in a good way now. There's like four of these dogs and I could see them starting to run, and two clearly came behind and two just ran on a tangent to where they were just going to cut me off. So at this point, like bolting through a swamp, have no strength, the saddle's in front of the wither. I'm just trying to keep like somehow my weight back so I don't flip the horse. And the dogs get closer and closer, and I'm like, well, this isn't looking good. This could be the end. I'm going to like get taken down by a pack of dogs. And then just literally as the dogs were like on the horse's heels about to like, what felt to me like they were going to bring it down, we get to one big swampy, streamy patch, and this horse just launches. Like it just is the most huge jump of anything I ever felt. And that just basically sails over top of the dogs, clears this kind of 6-foot-ish creaky swamp, hits the ground running on the other side, and does like another, you know, bolt of 5 kilometers, and we escaped. And it was just as much as the horse was a bit of a pain with its bolting, it probably saved both of our lives, and I've just never been so grateful. And it just hit the ground on the other side and picked up another gear of speed that I've never felt any horse have before. Like it just grew wings. It was just flying. And so, you know, that was that day's events.
Wowzers. So like full on wild dogs.
Yeah.
Did they have red collars on them?
They didn't have red collars on. And this was the only patch that was kind of close to town. So I think they might've just been kind of, you know, the Mongolian dogs are quite big as well. They're all kind of bigger than German shepherds.
That's what I was about to say, was if Chloe, yeah, Chloe says, yeah, she was chased by wild dogs in Mongolia and she thought they were going to bring the horse down, she's not imagining stuff. And, yeah, and when we were on the camel trip, they said that, you know, the dogs with red collars on them don't
pat them. Yeah, they bite.
Don't pat them. They bite. And, you know, like all the herders have, dogs around, they said, you know, if they've got a red collar, don't bite. And even the nice ones without red collars, don't be friendly with them and let them lick your face, yeah, because out there there's no toilets. And so when you go, you know, a little blur distance away from the camp and do your business. The dogs go there too and they eat what you left behind. So do not let the dogs lick your face.
Yeah, I think if the dogs don't get you, finish you off as they pull you off your horse, maybe the infection from the bites are not gonna be good.
Yes, I imagine so. Well, that's holy cow, that's crazy. That's while you were telling that story, having been there, not exactly where you were, but just picturing the kind of, like, they're big dogs. They're big, muscular, strong dogs. Yeah. And imagine, and those horses aren't real big either. I mean, there's not much difference between the dogs and the horses.
Nah, I reckon this pony was probably like 12 and a half hands, you know? Really? Like, some of them do get, 14 to 15 hands, but this one was particularly little. And the dogs felt like they were almost the same size as the pony as it was all happening.
So, for people who don't have a business card that says adventurer, can you talk us through what's going through your head?
When I'm being chased by wild dogs or just in general?
Oh, not in general. I don't want to hear that. That's probably too crazy. No, what's going through your head while you're being chased by wild dogs through swampy land in Mongolia to where you know the nearest hospital's 6 hours drive away on a horse that's got no mouth and you can't really steer him, you just got to go where he's going to go. What's going through your head?
I think, maybe one of the things I've been really lucky with is that in general, when situations get a bit hectic like that, I'm pretty good at, staying calm and kind of trying to come up with a plan. So, when this was happening, I was like, well, I'll just, there's no point holding onto the horse's face. Like, he can just have the reins as loose as he wants and he'll navigate us fleeing, and I'll just try and stay as far back in the saddle as I can and stop the saddle going over its head. And,
oh, so that's right, because you're not just worried about the dogs, you're worried about somersaulting the horse too, aren't you?
Yeah, it was really when all things can go wrong, they really did on that day. I think in at the back of my mind, I was in a pretty miserable state. So I was like, well, at least there's four dogs. I mean,
this is on the back of like the gastro bug, isn't it?
Just to add to
the adventurer, like, you don't put adventurer on your business card unless you want to have some adventure.
exactly. It was on the back of the gastro bug and hadn't eaten in a couple of days, so it wasn't at my best, really. I just remember being like really like, well, okay, we better figure this problem out to the best of our abilities. And if we can't, well, there's four dogs. At least it'll be kind of a quick end as opposed to just being mauled by one.
You were at that point?
It was probably like, I have to say, it probably went on the lowest points in my life, just because you are just so tired. I think you think you know what tired is, but until you go and do something like that and get yourself into that kind of situation, you really don't know what pure exhaustion is. And I just remember like being like, oh, well, we'll just see what we can do. But, you don't have the energy to be emotional about it. You're just like, well, and I remember like the day before being really, really miserable. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to let myself cry because that'll just dehydrate me more. So I was just determined to get on with the job and not, waste tears and dehydrate myself.
Keep your system dehydrated. I mean, hydrated. What day was this?
Yeah. I think day four.
Yeah. How many days did it take?
It took me 7.5 days.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was about halfway through the race at this point.
Yeah. Mm. And this is still not the day you almost died.
Yeah. I mean, that day, so much happened on this race. So that was a particularly bad day of near death by dogs. But I mean, and the day got better. Like, I did get into the next stage and did continue on riding and, got to that day finished with like one of the most amazing experiences of the Derby, where this family took me in. And this is many hours and a couple horses later since the dogs, and this amazing family took me in. And, I basically rode up to their yurt, their gur, and didn't really comprehend how bad I looked. But now, like, thinking back, like, this crazy random foreigner on a horse turned up at this herding family's door, and they just took me in and fed me and tried, like, they could see I was sick and kept trying to make me these meals, and they had yaks and made, like, yak yogurt and sugar for me to try and, like, perk me up. And we're just lovely. So I'd had this amazing experience this night after being chased by the dogs. And then the following night, I'd stayed with families before, and had, you know, just stayed with random herding families that are no part of the race. And Mongolia's got this great custom or great culture where they take in travellers, and are really incredibly generous in that way. But so after having this amazing night, I kept pushing, kept pushing, kept pushing. And I could see the riders in front of me. They were just ahead. They were kind of always just ahead of me. And you know, I'd overcome the sickness. And I really wanted to catch them and, you know, was not going to let them ride off. So it was getting close to evening and I couldn't find a place to stay this next night. And so eventually, like, found some, you know, like a fan, or yeah, some herders or some such. By a road, or by, not a road because there's no roads, but like by a track, and kind of thought I could stay there. And at the time there was like a woman and a couple of guys, and then the woman just mysteriously vanished later. And I was like, oh, this is, I'm not feeling real easy about this. Like, I'm feeling like the vibes are bad basically. But at this point, riding hours are over. I don't really have another option. It's late. And anyway, just, yeah, they all left for a bit and it was just me and some kids sleeping in this little cabin. And then it must have been after midnight, I could hear like a lot of commotion and, you know, like the general drunk talking, and it's easy to identify anywhere in the world. And some guys came, drove a motorbike basically to the edge of this gur and tried like dragging me out in my sleeping bag. And yeah, it just, one of those horrible experiences. And I remember just being so annoyed. Like, I was like, I am just so tired. Like, how dare you like ruin my chance at like recovering? And just being so furious about the whole situation that instead of like maybe panicking, I just remember like yelling at them. And, you know, that, and the kids that were there with me woke up and started yelling at them too. And luckily for me, they left me alone. And then a couple, I can't even remember, about an hour later, you know, another guy came along, tried dragging me out of my sleeping bag again. And so, yeah, just a horrible, hairy situation that was just all sorts of unpleasant. And as soon as I could, I just got on my horse that next morning and rode out there. But I think that was probably, to me, like the one time that I was in the type of danger that I couldn't solve on my own. Like, I feel like when it came to horses and dogs, like, I know enough about animals and the, you know, the natural world that I have a good chance of doing okay. But when it comes to, you know, people being the thing that is your enemy, yeah, it's a whole different thing. And you know, you feel incredibly vulnerable because suddenly you are weaker than the people attacking you. So, yeah, I was really, really lucky. I was really, really lucky that I got out of that pretty unharmed. But I think also just being exhausted and really pissed off about the whole situation probably helped me, because I just yelled right back at them.
That's a scary situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Horrific, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was really horrible. And especially because I'd had so many amazing experiences with so many amazing people before and since then. It was really horrific. And I remember just riding off the next morning, not kind of knowing how to deal with it. And luckily probably the race was on, and so I could just kind of focus on riding and racing. But it definitely, you know, I kept away from tracks or any area where there was like a lot of vehicle traffic from then on.
Yep.
And stayed to much more kind of remote areas if I was going to stay with people.
Wow. And that's, we keep getting to it. That's still not the time he almost died.
Oh gosh. Wait, what? Now you're testing me. What part have I forgot? I got chased by wild dogs. Guys.
Well, in the book you have this, or maybe we've already passed it, but in the book you have this whole thing about about it must have been when you'd had the IV in the middle of the night, but you know,
yeah,
like the, when everybody's leaving in the morning and you're like, you know, I can't even get out of bed, but I have to.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, this was actually earlier. This was before the wild dogs and before the unpleasant experience with the drunk guys, that I just woke up. I was just, yeah, we'd been pushing the limits. Like, you know, I'd gone there to push myself, and I definitely had been pushing. I think it was day three must have been the morning of day three or four. And I just remember waking up and you know, like, I do a lot of riding in my everyday life. Like, I've done a lot of competition. I've evented. Like, I know about rider fitness. And I just remember getting up and, like, any movement hurt. It just felt like glass was going through your knees. It was a pain that I can't even describe. And I've never felt it before or since, just where your joints feel like they're being torn apart with every little movement. I remember, like, even trying to sleep, you know, the littlest movement would wake you up. Yeah, just kind of waking up pre-dawn and thinking, like, I've got to get back on a horse and just, you know, I think at that point you're like lying in bed being like, I would really like to give up right now. I would, you know, it would be just easy to break an arm and like have it call it quits that way than, you know, to try and get yourself out of bed and back on a horse. But did get back on a horse that day. But yeah, probably the most excruciating pain I've ever been in my entire life. I think just from being run down was probably the onset of getting sick. You know, like in hindsight, it was probably, I was feeling so bad probably because I did have a fever and everything starting. It was just, it was painful. And I think, yeah, when you read stories about people who are on the verge of giving up, you're like, oh, well, you know, you just don't give up. But then when you're in that situation yourself, where you're that tired and in that much pain, you know, giving up or quitting sounds so sweet, and it really, really is difficult to keep going. But I think for me, it kind of kept me going that, A, it was my entire life savings. Like, I was never going to be able to come back and do this race again. And I think also knowing that people at home were following, I just couldn't bring myself to quit. Like I think I had the attitude that I'd have to be physically removed from the race from injury rather than giving up. Like, I just couldn't face the thought of just giving up on myself and not finishing. So, yeah, that was actually probably the most painful experience. Not everything else that came after it. But, yeah, that one particular morning was just awful, awful. I can't even think of a better way to describe it than it was just painfully awful.
So you've had
and then I got gastro.
And then you get gastro. Yeah, that was before the stomach bug. There was that, then the stomach bug, then the wild dogs, then the drunk guys. Did it get better after that?
Yeah, it did, definitely. So I think after the when I could start kind of like keeping a tiny bit of food down and stuff, I remember like the last 2 days I could have ridden 1,000 kilometers again. Like, and by the time the very last day, I felt fantastic. Like, I just thought, yeah, like I could keep going at this routine, this pace. Like, this is what I love doing. Like, this is my happy place, galloping across wide open country on horses. And I remember, you know, that last morning getting on a horse and galloping out of there, and you're galloping through this valley and had these kind of granite mountains that were reflecting this pink sunrise. It was just so beautiful. And then I come around this corner and there's all these camels grazing, and I'm like galloping my horse through these camels through this tall grass that's over my horse's head. And there's like this pink sunrise and beautiful mountains. And to me, like, that kind of stuff, you know, it erases the bad parts in your mind. And I think when I think of the Mongol Derby, I think of galloping over wide open spaces on amazing horses, just incredible horses. And yeah, it just, you know, despite everything bad that happened, it just had me hooked. I just loved it. I just couldn't get enough, really. And would happily, I was really disappointed when it finished, actually. I was like, oh, well, I was just getting into the groove of this. I'm just finally feeling like I'm fit and can do this justice. And then it was over.
And so that's your first introduction to Mongolia, but you've had a lot of time in Mongolia since then. Did you stay around after that, or did you go back after that?
I went back after that. So after the race, I think I was there maybe another few days recovering in the city and then went back. And just, I remember walking down the airport terminal, and, you know, you can see out, it's all glass, and, you know, there's the airport in UB, and you could see horses off on the hills in the distance, and feeling like, man, I need to get back here. Like, I'm not done. I'm not finished with this place. Like, it's got its claws into me. I'm hooked. So I remember, yeah, leaving for the first time and just feeling like in my core, in my bones, that I needed to come back. And there'd been other things I'd wanted to do in Mongolia that I'd known about before, but I couldn't do on this trip. Like, I'd read about the reindeer and the eagle hunters and all that kind of stuff. And so I spent kind of the next couple months researching other things I could come back to Mongolia for. And then the opportunity came up to come in that in 2014 to work on the Mongo Derby. And you didn't need to ask me twice. I jumped at that. So I went back and worked on the Derby, watched from the other side of the fence, you know, being part of the crew and watching riders, and then went up to Duka people. I was running the blood wagon. So we were like, not the medics, but we were like the rescue team.
The blood wagon. It's pretty ominous sounding.
Very ominous sounding. Good description for it. So yeah, like if there was riders that had fallen off, that it wasn't a massive emergency, like wasn't a medical emergency, we'd try and go and find them. We'd try and track down horses that had parted ways with their riders, and generally just, yeah, were part of the team that kept the Mongol Derby going. Yeah, so we ended up with a lot of the riders that didn't make it, and tried to keep them entertained and get them to the finish line so they could watch people cross the finish line. And just loved it. Loved being part of the Derby in a various roles. Like, it was great because you still get the excitement. Like, I remember one particular day, you know, we're like sitting on the step. We know kind of where the races are. We know where the riders are. And I've got my driver and my translator, and we're kind of sitting there making soup, actually. And then this herd of like 150 horses just comes like galloping over the horizon, and, you know, that thundering of hooves, and then, you know, horses go either side of us, and my translator's still making soup, and my driver's off in the bushes doing his business, and then one of the horses has one of the Mongol Derby saddles on it, and they're like, that's not a good sign. There's 150 horses and one horse with a rider's saddle on it. So we're like trying to like hustle and like get us all back in the, abandon the soup making for lunch and get it back in the van and try and track this horse down and like kind of like wait to hear from HQ if we know the rider's okay. Like, do we need to get the horse back to the rider? Do we need to find where the rider is and get it to the horse? Yeah, that's one of the standout memories of crewing it. I loved it. I thought it was just great because, you know, I wasn't on a, there was no suffering for me this time. I just got to enjoy everything that was great about the race from the comfort of a vehicle.
You know, what's funny about this podcast is almost everybody I've had on the podcast, I know and I've spent time with. And when you know people and you spend time with them, you swap stories. And so a lot of times I get people on the podcast because, hey, you've got this great story. But you told me some really cool stories about your time crewing on the Mongol Derby, but I'm not exactly sure how many of them you can actually tell me on the podcast.
Yeah, I think a few of them might be a little bit too sensitive for the podcast. But in general, like, I just loved it. I just thought it was amazing, and I think, you know, like, I know what I went through and how, you know, grueling it was, and it was really, I think the one thing that surprised me was how humbling it was to be around people who were at that point as well. And watching people overcome adversity, I think that's, you know, on a serious note, that's something I really got out of crewing Derby is, you know, it's a real privilege to be there. And I think people should take it that way, to see people at their lowest and watch people overcome adversity. Like, I've seen at the start camp, you know, you kind of look at all the riders and you kind of have your ideas about who might finish and who might not, and yeah, there's a few that are really obvious and, you know, probably don't make it, but then there's a few people that you probably write off at start camp that just overcome every single obstacle, and they are so inspiring to watch. And I think it just, yeah, it's a really amazing experience to watch these people go and do this race, knowing how hard it was when I did it, and, you know, watch people go through really dark moments, come out the other side really glowing, and you think of them as just amazing people. I mean, some, it's a bit like the Hunger Games, maybe they don't come off quite as glowing, but yeah, I really, really appreciated watching people go through it and come out the other side as better people.
What's the attrition rate? Like, how many people complete the how many people give up?
About 50% finish, maybe. I think a little bit less than 50% finish my year, sometimes a bit more, but around 50-50. Yeah, usually about 50%
don't make it. And it's not all, like, medical, you know, it's not all they break arms. Like, some people just go, I can't do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, so I've ridden it a couple more times and been the on-horse camera woman. And so I've gotten to ride, you know, bits of the Derby with various people. And I remember riding... won the first leg, I think, and someone just being like, you know what, this isn't for me. Like, they got to the first vet station and were like, nah, I don't like the open spaces. I don't like this. This is, nah, it's not for me. I'm out. And that was that. They were out by the first 40 kilometers. And so, yeah, some people just get out there and, you know what, it's just not for them. Or the various medical things. But, yeah, there's I mean, a fair call to them that they recognize it's not what they feel that they can achieve, and they just turn around and pack up.
Yeah, and I think with things like that, it's not necessarily, you know, it's nothing to judge them on, because they probably do stuff, other parts of their life that we couldn't do, but it's just not for them.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I know people who, you know, like, have been around the horses, and they some of the things we do with horses, like, there's just no way I could do that. But in their life, I'm like, there's no way I could do that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting to see. Sorry, that's my gigantic dog in the background protecting me.
That's Chloe's dog. That's not my dog.
It's definitely mine. But yeah, I think, you know, full credit to those people who say it's completely out of their skill set and don't do it, because it's not for everyone. Just the local bunny rabbit population invading or something.
Is that what it is? You know, it's funny, when we went on the when we went on the Gobi camel trip, you've done it three times, but the one that I went on, you know, there was a lady from Canada there who's never ridden any animal astride.
Yeah.
And rode every step of the way.
Just nailed it, eh? And I think I think I got that from crewing the Derby, and I what I loved, and what I've tried to carry on, like, into my own expeditions now, is you just can't write people off on appearances, like, or what their history is. You just don't know who's going to end up really shining and being really tough and having some incredible mental fortitude, and others that won't. And I think that's a really really fascinating thing to watch, I guess, in human nature, is seeing the ones that, because you're right, you know, that lady hadn't had any experience horse riding or camel riding. And I think, like, when she applied, you know, like, she'd said, like, I've done some, like, horse trekking or something, maybe. Because, like, usually I try to take only experienced horse people. And she got there and was like, oh, no, I've never really done anything like this. I'm like, hang on, how did you slip through the cracks? Like, how have you gotten yourself here? And actually, she was absolutely fine. And she was a really standout. She just kept on going. And I've seen that with so many other things, you know, on other expedition style events. It just amazes me. People amaze me. The ones that just turn out to be so tough and not always the ones you think.
Yeah, like, I was amazed with her. Like, you know, I've not really done any endurance horse stuff. Like, you know, so we I mean, I've, you know, I trained horses for 20 years for a living, so I was on horses all day long. But you're on, and then you're off, and then you're on another one, and you're off, and whatever. Yeah. But just the constant go, like, endurance sort of thing. Yeah. And there were times there, like, I was struggling a bit, and this lady's name was Bonnie, and Bonnie just kept on keeping on. Like, she was amazing.
Yeah, she was incredible. She was just absolutely amazing. I've had a couple other people like that. Like, he's a good friend now, Trent, who came on the first expedition. And he hadn't ridden either. I think maybe he'd done some, you know, like, beach horse tricks or something like that. And I actually met him in Fiji, because he was doing aid work in Fiji and I was doing animal welfare work in Fiji. And, you know, I'd seen that he was okay in remote environments. I was like, oh, yeah, why don't you come on this camel trek? And he was another one that just kept on going. Like, yeah, no real experience, and just had such a strong determination that he would make it every single day, and did. And by the end, could really ride, same as Melanie, you know, by the end of it, they've spent so many hours in the saddle that they'd put some much more experienced camel riders to shame, probably, or horse riders to shame.
Yeah, she was pretty amazing. So you, we were just talking about, you had been to the back to the Mongol Derby to be on the crew. No, but after your first one, you said you then went, oh, you went back and then you crewed, but then you went to the Dooka people. Let's talk about them.
Yeah. So the Dooka people in northern Mongolia are a really small group of people who still ride reindeer, like ride, not, you know, one leg on each side of the reindeer, not be pulled by a sled or anything like that.
Not Santa Claus.
And they live in these mountains. And they live quite high up in the mountains, and there's about 200 people, you know, maybe 40 families that are living this lifestyle where they still kind of completely rely on the reindeer for everything. And animal behaviors always fascinated me. It's kind of what led me to the Mongol Derby in the first place. And I was like, well, I really want to know how you train reindeer. Like, you know, maybe there's something to learn for horse behavior in here. You know, maybe there's some tips and tricks I could pick up from these reindeer trainers. And plus, it just sounded magical. So in 2014, I had a couple of friends, two friends with me, and we're like, well, let's just go and see if we can find our way there. And so we basically flew north, got a driver in this old Russian-style Ural van, and then headed out to basically as far as you can drive, about another entire day's off-road driving. And luckily on the way, randomly met someone who's like, oh yeah, my, you know, like I think one of his family members had married into these Dooka people. And so he hooked us up with horses and off we went into the mountains. And I just...
By the way, yeah. You guys listening, this is what adventurers do. There's some people really in northern Mongolia that ride reindeer, and we want to go see them. So what we're going to do is we're not going to plan anything. We're going to get on a plane. We're going to fly there. And then we're going to get into some car with some random Russian dude and drive for a day. And then we're going to meet some other random dude who happens to know one of them. He's going to get us some horses, and then we're going to go meet him. That's how you do it?
Yeah, pretty much.
This is like the guidebook on how to be an adventurer.
how most good adventures start, I think. It's not really an adventure if there's too much planning involved. You're missing all the good stuff. And it took us a couple of days riding, and I just remember coming over this incredible mountain pass, and it was like glacier and ice on one side and really steep, and then you come onto these high mountain kind of almost plateau-like valleys, and I see like these little teepees as like tiny specks in the distance that we're trying to find our way to. And it was just incredible. It's like one of those things where I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is beyond my wildest dreams. And so we found our way to this family. I'm just going to wait for him to stop barking again. It's another bunny attack, apparently.
Apparently so. Those New Zealand bunnies are pretty bad.
I know.
You know, you go, I can actually see Chloe, and she was... I can see her head and her shoulders, and before, behind her, her dog's got this tail that sticks straight up in the air, and it looked like this big feather just going backwards and forwards behind you, kind of like a shark's fin sticking out of the ocean, like dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, going back and forwards behind you. That is a big dog. What is he?
He's a Central Asian Shepherd, so... Despite being chased by the Mongolian dogs, I do have a really soft spot for them and learned to love them over subsequent years. And then I spent a bit of time in Kazakhstan, and they have a similar type of dog, and I just fell in love with the Kazakh dogs and made some Kazakh friends who actually had taken some dogs to Australia. And so a couple of years ago, I got myself a big Kazakh dog from Australia, and this is Khan, who's interrupting the podcast with his bunny protection scheme and barking. Meant to be fighting wolves in Kazakhstan, but he's here protecting me from bunnies in New Zealand.
You
got to
watch out for those bunnies. Yeah. So you're at the reindeer people. Then what happens?
Yeah. So I mean, again, it's just this amazing environment. This kind of high alpine, swampy, windy, icy place. I'm not making it sound beautiful, but it is really beautiful in a kind of really raw way. And there's these kids here, and like there's like these two kids that could probably come up to my shoulders, and they're wielding this big chainsaw cutting up firewood for the fires in the teepee, which was an amazing sight in itself. And then there's this girl and she's cooking tea, and we've been there like, you know, 45 minutes. And then, you know, we go outside and this woman just comes riding over the other side of the mountain on her reindeer, and she's wearing this amazing purple dell, and she's on this reindeer with a full head of antlers. And it was like a pinch yourself moment. It was just so surreal, so amazing. And it was like the tiniest bit of snow in the air. And it just, it felt like I was in a fairy tale. Like it just felt like I was living a fairy tale, you know, beyond what I ever could have hoped that I was going to see. Just one of those once in a lifetime moments. And so, yeah, we spent a bit of time up there with this family and really loved it. Got to ride reindeer and have been going back and visiting that same family now since 2014. So this time last year, as COVID was all kind of exploding all over the world, in February, right after we did the camel trip for Warwick, I went up north and visited this family again, this time in winter. And, you know, I've been there so many times in summer and spring and autumn, and I'd never been in winter. And again, one of those things that, you know, at this point, like I've done all these Gobi crossings where it gets to like negative 45. I think I know what cold is. I've been to this reindeer country before. I think I know what the reindeer are. And then we get up there in winter, and they'd always said, you know, no one comes in winter. No one comes in winter. It's impossible. It's impossible. Impossible. And then finally, about 2 years ago, they said, you know, like, why don't you come in winter? You know, we know you really want to see this winter. We'll make it happen. You get as close as you can and we'll come with the reindeer and get you. And so we went with a Belgian filmmaker and Tess and Big Man, who helped me run the camel expeditions. And we went up in winter, and it was just unbelievably different to summer, to when I first went in 2014. First of all, the snow's so deep, it's over your head in most places. And so, you know, these guys, they navigate because they know the land so well. There's no discernible tracks. And it's just so, so remote. They're so much further into the mountains, and it's just a completely different lifestyle to in summer. You know, it can get to negative 50, negative 55 up there, and they're in these canvas teepees, and they're out, you know, riding wolf patrol every night, and they're moving with their reindeer constantly. Like they have a philosophy of just following their deer. It's much more, you know, the reindeer dictate their lifestyle, not them dictating the reindeer's lifestyle. It's this amazing symbiosis kind of life that I haven't even seen anywhere else. And yeah, spent 10 days up there in winter, and just, it was that awe-inspiring, unworldly feeling all over again, you know, to see Maxa, who I'd seen on the very first trip, the husband, the father on the very first trip, and then seeing him this winter and just watching the reindeer in these deep snows and impassable. And Maxa was, he had a camp close, so that we could get to him. That close camp was like 3 days, it would have been almost 5 days of traveling from UB, but 3 days of kind of traveling from the nearest proper town. And the next family was 3 days further into the wilderness than him. So they're just so unimaginably remote out there. And we actually saw some of the guys as we were going in, some guys were coming out, and they'd been in there for 3 months, and they were traveling out, and they had these old rifles on their reindeer, and they had their reindeer skins that they sleep in. And, you know, they were trying to get back to see their families for the Mongolian New Year. And, you know, they'd just been journeying in the snow for 3 days with, you know, a handful of rations, some reindeer skins, and that was just their life. And just, it's a different world. I don't even know how to do it justice, but yeah, you're up in these high mountains with a lot of snow and a lot of reindeer, and it just is incredible what everyday normal life is for them. Is like a unbelievably amazing experience to us.
Didn't you, I know you spent some time with them, so I imagine you're in GERS, but I remember seeing some pictures you put on Facebook. You guys were sleeping outside in the snow, yes, in sleeping bags, and it was minus whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, something like minus 30, I think it was. So like, so the Sujuka people live in teepees, unlike where we were with the camels, where they live in the GERS, which are much more insulated. Anyway, so I see these like hunters, like, and I've heard about this. Max has told us, you know, like when we travel, we don't sleep in tents, you know, coming and going from our winter camps, we just sleep in the snow. So in my mind, I'm like, well, we've got to like if we're going to do this, like, let's do this right. Like tents are cheating. Like, if they're sleeping outside, we're sleeping outside. And so, yeah, we, and plus it's like on the side of a mountain. It's not the easiest place to pitch tents in deep snow anyway. So yeah, on our travels in, we just slept under the stars, you know, with a fire about 20 meters away, in these ice cold conditions. Like, my saddle was completely frozen solid the next morning when I went to get on my reindeer. And my sleeping bag, you know, it's pretty insulated, but on top of it is like ice, and you have to sleep in like full balaclavas. And yeah, just pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing what you can do, though. I think, you know, like, yeah, it's really, really cold, and you're up in the mountains and there's wolves and stuff around, but the wolves aren't going to come into camp. And it is just amazing what humans can do. I think what sounds impossible from a cushy Western lifestyle is just very possible when you're used to doing it. I will say it's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. Like, I was genuinely cold all day, every day. And in the camel trips in the Gobi, I'm never cold. And, you know, it's been negative 45 there and I haven't been cold. Whereas up in these mountains, I was cold for a good part of it. And it was just exhausting. Like, when you got off the reindeer and you were trying to go through deep snow, just every footstep, you're climbing uphill, and then it would be like whiteout conditions, so you can't see the person in front of you. It was, I think, probably one of the most challenging expeditions I've ever done was the one last winter. And then when we did get to camp, they had one teepee and it was pretty crowded. So I was like, oh, it's fine. We'll camp under a tree. So we just got an old bit of canvas and camped outside under a tree for the whole time we were there. It was fine. It was good. Beautiful views. You woke up to like starry skies in the night. It just was very, very challenging trying to get in and out of your sleeping bag without everything, you know, like all your clothes freezing solid on you. But other than that, it was amazing. I probably would take a tent next time, though. I don't know if I'd repeat it twice.
You've done it. No, don't need to do it again.
Yeah, the bivouacking in negative 30 has been ticked off the list.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we took some good sleeping bags when we went to Mongolia on the trip, because, you know, you gave us a really good list of stuff we needed, and we had all this good gear, and we're in the Gers at night time. Yeah. And, you know, it was mostly too hot more than too cold. How cold is it, if you can even explain it in words, sleeping outside in a sleeping bag at like negative 30 whatever at night time? Are you just unbelievably frozen and you go to sleep anyway, or is it keep you awake?
So once you're in the sleeping bag, like, I've got pretty good gear. I've been really lucky to have brilliant sleeping bags and stuff like that. So once in the sleeping bags, cozy as anything, absolutely fine. Okay. And, you know, like, I'm really disciplined, I think, about being like, right, these are the conditions, this is how you have to use your gear, you know. And being like, right, you get in and you can't move about heaps. You've got to have good layering. You have to have good layering, but you can't wear, you know, 10 layers. You have to give each, you know, merino layer or wool layer that you're wearing enough time to work as insulation and stuff. So, and just never, you just can't be lazy in those kind of extremes. So, like, there's systems. So, you know, if you take your boots off, your boot liners and everything go down to the bottom of your sleeping bag so that they're not frozen solid and you don't put your foot into a ice block tomorrow. And you just have to be very disciplined that you can't lose a single piece of your kit either. So you have to know where your gloves are at every single moment. So your gloves are tucked down the side of your sleeping bag. Because I think that's the one thing, you know, with that extreme cold, you stick your hand out, you know, maybe grab something in the night, and it just, your fingers get, they're just ice. You lose all sensation so, so quickly, and it hurts. Warming them back up is so incredibly painful. You just want to avoid that at all costs. And I know, like, having been in the Gobi when it's been really cold, the one thing you notice is you can almost feel your teeth cracking, you know. So when it gets down to negative 5, you shouldn't expose your mouth and teeth, and you can, you know, cause hairline fractures in your teeth from the change in temperature. And if you do take a big mouthful of negative 45 air, you just feel like it just burns your lungs like nothing else, and you can feel like your teeth almost cracking. And I think that extreme cold is just, if you don't manage it right, it's just painful, and the pain of trying to warm up makes you really disciplined at being really proactive. But in general, like as far as on the camel trips, like on my camels, I have never ever been cold because I've just stuck to the Mongolian gear. And I think when I went up to the reindeer, I just didn't have quite the right gear for during the day. For when I was riding, I didn't have the right gear. And that was just bitter. Didn't have the right boots. I couldn't take my normal boots that I take on the camels because they're just too big to walk in. So I had these like stupid plastic Western style boots that just froze my feet. They were awful. And so for like 10 days, my feet were just icicles. The only time they were warm was in my sleeping bag. So being on the reindeer was not a pleasurable experience. And I think even in the teepees, they don't hold the warmth. So you can be warm if you've got your back to the fire, but otherwise you're cold. They don't have the warmth that the gurs do. So, yeah.
Yeah, those gurs can get kind of warm when they stoke the fire.
They're like saunas. Yeah.
You know, we took, the foot warmer things you can stick in the body things. And I think the first day on the camels, Tyler actually put them in his feet, and that night he's like, I'm not putting them in here again. My feet were too hot all day. Because those boots you guys got us were so warm.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're amazing. They're just so well insulated. Not great for walking up mountains in, but great for riding a camel and keeping your legs warm.
Yeah, I imagine they're not good for walking up mountains. I remember talking to you at one point in time a few years ago, and you were talking about some of your first encounters with the Dooka people, and you told me a story. At the time, you said it was the most surreal thing you'd ever seen before. Do you remember? Mm. Do you remember telling me this story?
I think everything about that was surreal. I don't know which particular story because I found the whole thing.
It was something like you get up early one morning and you walk outside the tent, teepee, whatever you're in, and out of the next tent comes this little 10-year-old boy, and the sun's about to come over the hill, and he kind of yawns, has a big old stretch, runs over, jumps on the back of the nearest reindeer and rides over the hill into the rising sun.
I think it just always filled with moments like that. Like just some kid's like, oh, I've got to go like herd up the reindeer. So just jumps on his reindeer and off he goes to like bring in 200 reindeer by himself. Yeah, just all those moments are just incredible, I think. And it never gets old. I've seen it so many times now and it's still just, I think it all just feels like a big fairy tale that you're living in sometimes when you see stuff like that.
You know, there is a meme that goes around Facebook every once in a while, and it's this picture of this Mongolian warrior sitting on his Mongolian pony wearing a wolfskin cloak with a Mongolian hunting eagle on his arm, and the meme says, you might be cool, but you're not Mongolia warrior wearing a wolfskin cloak while riding his Mongolian pony with a Mongolian hunting eagle on his arm cool. You're not that cool. You might be cool, but you're not that cool. Your profile picture on Facebook is of Chloe Phillips Harris, horsewoman, adventurer, journalist, sitting upon a Mongolian pony while wearing a wolfskin cloak and having a hunting eagle on her arm. Tell us all about that.
I'm just always fascinated. Like I think the one thing that always drives me is again animal behavior. So I was like, well, you know, there's these reindeer and then there's these people that hunt with eagles. Like, how do you train an eagle? Like, I need to know this. And same principle. So these days, you know, I've been in Mongolia a lot. I've got a great network. You know, I know how to find what I'm looking for, or I will know someone who will know how to find it for me. But back then in 2014, I didn't really know anyone. And so similar approach that I was like, well, I know the eagles are out west, so we'll just catch a flight out west. And so we did.
That's how the adventurers do it, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we got to the airport and we kind of like loosely organized maybe a driver that could pick us up, but he never showed up. And so like everyone's left. And this airport is like in the middle of a desert. You know, there's just like brown mountains all around you, brown sand, like nothing that looks conducive to life kind of around this airport. And everyone's like disappeared. We're the last ones there at this airport. We're just sitting on the step being like, well, there's not even any cars coming down the road. Like, And then finally, the airport control guy comes out and he's kind of the last car and he's like, do you guys want to ride into town? Like, can I help you here? I'm like, yeah, we would love a ride into town. Like, yeah, at least from town we might be able to make a bit of plan. And anyway, his name was Wing, and he gave us a ride into town and gave us a tour of this little town. And yeah, bada bing, bada boom, many connections later, we find someone who knows some eagle hunters, and it's like, yeah, well, of course, like, I can't stay, but I can get you to one of these eagle hunters, and you can stay there, and I'll just come back in a few days and get you. And I was like, yes, like, fine, this is fine with me. I'm going to see eagle hunters. I'm going to see how they hunt with eagles. This is all good. I think my companion was pretty dubious about the plan at the stage, but I was all in. So off we went. And to my good fortune, the eagle hunter that this guy dropped us off with was the eagle hunting champion of Mongolia.
Of course he was.
So I think he's been on some Nat Geo documentaries and things like that. And it just so happened that we got dropped off with this amazing eagle hunter and spent some time with him. And at first, you know, like, being a woman, they were like, oh, do you want to just sit inside? We'll just look after you, like, you know, like, have some tea. Not in a, like, strongly sexist way, but just in, like, they felt very responsible that nothing bad happened to me. And I think this is where I've always been lucky, that my ability to ride a horse has opened a lot of doors for me in a lot of places. And sure enough, like, eventually went horse riding. They're like, oh, well, she can ride a horse pretty well. So, okay. And so from there, they kind of let us go out. They showed us how they hunted with the hawks, and then got to go out with them and see how they hunted with the eagles, and got to ride around with the eagle on my arm. Those are really heavy birds, so I couldn't ride very far, I have to say. Yeah, and just an amazing, and again, someone who was an amazing stockman as well as eagle hunter. You know, like, this is a pretty arid environment, and he was an amazing horseman. Maybe not in the horsemanship that me and you are familiar with, but an amazing horsemanship in how to manage and train horses in that environment. And he had camels and sheep and goats and eagles and hawks and falcons, and clearly someone that just knew animals, lived with animals day in, day out, relied on animals for their life, and had a huge amount of respect for the animals as they were. And, you know, he used his hunting eagles, but still really respected them as eagles, and the individuals that they were, and didn't try to make them into, you know, tame talking parrots or anything like that. And he was very much like, well, when they've hunted for me for a while, I try to release them and kind of wean them back into the wild so that they can go and breed. And just a phenomenal person to spend time with. And I feel really, really lucky that I got to spend time with him and picked up a lot of things, and just, it was an incredible experience. I think the great, you know, the Facebook photo was, you know, a great photo, but I think more what I gathered was just this amazing, I want to call it stock sense for lack of a better word, but connection to the animals that he lived with was really incredible. And I think people who are good horsemen anywhere in the world, or, you know, good camel trainers or good eagle trainers or whatever. And it's always amazing to me to be around those people. You always pick up nuances, and it makes you rethink how you work with your own animals. And yeah, it just was such an amazingly privileged experience to have had. And I think I was probably quite lucky in that I got in there kind of before the whole eagle tourism thing took off. I know that that's really, like, probably before COVID, that was really kind of booming and maybe had kind of altered the scene over there a little bit. And I probably kind of just got in there that last wave before, you know, tourists were really going over there. And yeah, it was incredible. I'm hoping I can go back out west, maybe for future expeditions. We're looking at doing another camel trek out there and kind of staying with a few eagle hunters along the way.
Really?
If the world opens up again, gonna hopefully do some more work out that way, because yeah, I think it's an amazing environment out there and something I would still love to do more with.
Wow. After our camel trip, which was the third one you'd done, you had another trip organized that was just so our camel trip was 300 kilometers. You had another trip organized that someone I know was going to go on that thing. And it was 1,200 kilometres, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I love these wild parts in the world and you know, where nature is still the ruler. You know, everyone bends around nature, not the other way around. And I love the connection with animals. And I'm really lucky to have two partners in Mongolia that I work with, and we're all pretty on the same page with things. And, you know, for our camel expedition, we have tried to do it in the coldest 10 days of winter every year, because if you're going to do it on a camel expedition, why not do it on the coldest 10 days of winter? You know, like, it's got to be a real adventure. And we had been like thinking and thinking for years, and we wanted to do something kind of next level that can really celebrate Mongolia's really diverse nomadic culture and heritage. And so we came up with the idea of the Great Nomad Expedition. We started kind of on the southern border with Mongolia and went straight north, starting on camels, doing a little bit on horses, going over some mountains on some yaks, back to some horses, and then finishing up with some reindeer. So kind of going, I think it's 27 days, basically south to north, and so that people... Again, so, you know, it's a challenge. It's a physical challenge to do something like that, but it's also an amazing chance to see this, like, this incredible diversity in these animals and these people who live with the animals in a really unique way, because there's nothing like crossing an environment with an animal. It just changes your whole perspective. You know, driving across the country just does not give you the same feel for the land that, you know, being out there crossing it day in, day out does. And so, yeah, that's what we are still hoping to do. We're kind of postponing. We haven't called it off. But, yeah, so that was the next challenge, was the Great Nomad Expedition, using camels, horses, yaks, and reindeer, and kind of celebrating and mixing and mingling and hanging out with and crossing the land with these amazing animals and staying with these amazing herders. I can't wait to do it. I'm still really amped. I was gutted that we had to call it off and postpone it last year, but I'm hoping that maybe not this year, but next year we can make it all happen.
So it was the first 250 kilometers, I think, was supposed to be camels, weren't they?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then you went to horses for a while, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And so for our winter expeditions, we do about 30-ish Ks on a camel every day. And then for this one, we'd be doing 60 kilometers on a camel every day, and then swapping camels each day. And then, yeah, you go for some horses. And then using some yaks to get through the mountains, and then
you keep glossing over that, but I think that's the most fascinating part. You can't ride anything else through the mountains, so you got to ride yaks.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And like, I just think yaks look awesome, and I think the opportunity to hang out with them and learn some yakmanship, or, you know, yak wrestling, or however it turns out you have to do to get yaks moving, sounds like a great opportunity. And it's going through some really scenic areas that's probably not great for horses, but too steep, but a great chance to kind of go through these beautiful mountains. And, you know, after some quite fast-paced camel riding and horse riding, a chance to kind of ease off the pace for a little while, go a bit slow, let people recover for a few days on yak back, and then back to some fast-paced horse riding
on yak back. You know, we did about 30 kilometers a day on the camels. And when you told me, the Great Nomad Expedition, we do 60 kilometers a day on camels, I'm thinking, I don't know if I could do that.
I reckon you've got it in you. I think, like, you'll be surprised. Once you get into the rhythm, you can just keep going. So I think even with the camel expedition, you know, the first day is pretty hard, but then once you get into the rhythm, it's pretty easy.
The second day was pretty hard. The long day was pretty hard.
It gets easier towards the second half anyway.
Are the camels more forward in the summertime?
Yeah, and I think you've got longer riding hours as well. And you know, we're pretty conservative on the camels in winter, because we're very conscious that we don't want them losing weight in winter, because it's a long, cold winter over there. So we try to be really conservative on how we use the camels in winter. Whereas, you know, doing it in summer, you can go a bit faster, go longer distances, because they'll be fitter. You know, in winter they're not running around the Gobi quite as much, but in summer, you know, their trainers, their owners can put a bit of time into actually getting them fitter, and yeah, so we can cover a bit more speed, do a bit more speed and cover a bit more ground.
You know, when Tyler and I did the podcast about the trip, I think I mentioned there that the camels, I found they had like three speeds at the trot. Or they pace, yeah. but there's this really slow speed that you can sit to all day long.
Yeah.
And then when you really get them going, there's this fast speed, and they make you go up and down. You don't have to do any work. But most of the time is spent at somewhere in between them, where in order to sit to it, You really have to engage your core to sit to it, or or you rise up and down, but you don't get thrown up and down. You actually have to. It's like doing squats all day long, you know. And so if they're in the slow pace or the fast pace, it's kind of easy. And that other pace they spend most of the time at, you're doing some sort of work. You're either doing the squats or you're just – or you're holding a plank, you know, like you're holding your core. Basically. And, like, it was so fun when those cameras – like that – the second day, that longest day when we got lost and we're coming into camp after the sun went down. And those camels must have got a sniff of the camp or figured out, but they got up and they were going. It's like, now that was fun, just trotting along a million miles an hour on those camels. That's cool.
Yeah, that feeling of crossing country on like an animal that's wanting to cross country is just amazing. But yeah, I think also there's like camels, and then there's comfortable camels, and then there's like camels that are just not comfortable. And it has, like, I don't know what the secret is, but it has something to do with like their hump conformation or. Because, you know, you can go the same speed on two different camels and one is so jarring. It's like sitting on a sewing machine, and one you can sit there all day and go on. So there's definitely a bit of luck in the draw of whether you get a camel with comfortable paces or if you get one that's a little bit less comfortable, or, you know, if some of them have like their, because the Mongolian camels have two humps. So some of them, you know, their hump conformation is really cozy. You just sit in there and you're really comfortable. And then others, it's like, really like I don't know, like having a plank of wood on your back that just is just not that comfortable at all. So like, I always say I love riding camels, and I absolutely do. Like, my happy place is just, you know, trotting across the Gobi Desert on my camel and just watching the horizon. But I do admit that there's some camels that I'm pretty happy to say goodbye and get on to the next one.
So you've got so those are two hump camels, but you've got quite a bit of experience, or had some experience with the single hump camels as well, haven't you?
Yeah, the dromedaries. So I have done work in Australia with Australian Desert Expeditions, or the Outback Camel Company, and they run these amazing programs where they go out into some of the most remote areas in Australia with camels, and they fill up the camel teams with all your water, your food, everything you're going to need. And they do desert surveys every winter. So they're out there surveying these desert environments, looking at the plants, the wildlife, invasive species, artifacts, looking at the archaeology. And because, I mean, there's so many huge parts of Australia that have still really never been explored. And so they do this on camels because camels are not going to destroy the land that they're crossing. And so you basically... load up your camel teams, and this time you're on foot and you just walk, and you just walk beside these huge, huge camels all day, kind of surveying. If you get to an interesting site where there might be, you know, some archaeological stuff to find, then you might camp down for a couple of days and really survey the site, or otherwise you keep walking. And so I was really lucky to join the team there as a camelier and work with the one-humped camels. And I love them, eh? I think they just have such a bad reputation, and everyone makes jokes about camels. But they are so incredibly intelligent, and they are so willing to work. And they do things that no other animal could do. I mean, they carry insane loads, and they cross these amazing deserts without a drink of water. They just keep on trucking. And they're massive. Like, I just think it's impossible to explain how humongous camels are, especially the one-humped camels, until you're right up next to them or leading a string of, like, six or seven tied together. And then, yeah, I mean, it's like a freight train behind you. Incredible animals, and an incredible project, or incredible work that they're doing in Australia with their desert surveys and scientific research that they do out there. I just love being part of it. I absolutely love it. And you know, you get to work with scientists and environmentalists and archaeologists, and just an inspiring group of people to be around. And you know, my passion is definitely the camels and the animal side of it, but it's just amazing to sit around, you know, a campfire at night and listen to other people who are, you know, looking at ancient remains and can tell you about the area, looking at stone tools or things that are being found out there, or, you know, looking at the environment, or it's just incredible. And I've just seen camels do amazing things, and so different from horses, so different from horses and how they think and operate. It's really humbling to be kind of the first time being kind of back at the beginning of what you know about a species. When we've come from, you know, knowing quite a bit about horses, you're back to beginner camel level.
Yeah, I imagine you're probably back to the beginning of maybe having your knowledge of that particular species. But,
yeah,
you know, if you think about all the lessons you learn from horses, a lot of that's got to carry over. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely.
You know what I mean? It's not like you've never been around an animal before.
Yeah.
It's just, you've just, you know, you bring a lot of life skills and, you know,
yeah,
patience and understanding and empathy and compassion and probably a, you know, a sense of awareness how big they are and how little we are and how to just stay out of the wrong spot, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that always kind of humbles me with camels is that they can bite in 180 degrees and pretty much kick in every single direction with one leg or another. So they're a loaded gun at all times. You know, they make horses seem pretty safe, really, when you're on the ground handling them. But yeah, I mean, there's so much crossover. And I think the empathy and you know, realizing you're dealing with an animal that's got its own behavior that's not exactly like ours is yeah, and you, it's great to be able to stand back and cross over some of those skills. And yeah, I think it's just, it took, you know, it takes you a bit while to get your eye in on what camel behavior is compared to a horse behavior, because, you know, the horses are, to me, really, really easy to read. And definitely the first time I went out to the Australian desert, I was like, oh, I'm not, yeah, I mean, I get animal behavior, I get prey animal behavior, I get, you know, this large herbivore behavior, but it just did take me. And again, I think being very conscious of damage horses can do to people and realizing that these guys are twice as big and have a different kind of brain that can kind of think and plan ahead a bit more than a horse, you know, it did make me pretty cautious the first couple of days around them. And then you get your eye in and you start to read their behavior and you're like, these animals are really, really cool, but they are awesome.
You know, the thing I felt about the camels in the Gobi was how, I don't want to anthropomorphize too much, but how human-like they were.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, especially not being, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, horses, like if a horse is in, and I think it's because they're a prey animal, but if a horse is in pain, they go ooh, quiet. Whereas like I heard camels,
yeah,
sound like a baby, like a baby human, like expressing their disgust at something or if they're in pain for some reason.
And
it's surprisingly human-like.
Yeah, it is surprising. And I think like they do have a very different type of intelligence to a horse as well. Like I'm not saying one's more intelligent than the other, but it's just two different type of minds to work with. And yeah, they're just amazingly intelligent and vocal, and unfortunately their noises are not always the most attractive, so I think that gives them a bad name as well, but they are intelligent. Once you get to know them, they're really sweet. And if you get ones that like a scratch and you know you can give them a good scratch on the neck, they make these beautiful little sounds and kind of nuzzle into you. And I had a beautiful camel when we did that, the camel expedition, called Tiny Tim, and he was just like the snuggliest little cute little camel that just loved, like, and he came from this family that all their camels loved cuddles, and he loved cuddles and he loved like a big hug around the neck, and he kind of leant into you and he'd bury his head in your chest. And he was just like a little, like a, you know, a lap dog, but times 1,000.
Yeah, Tiny Tim, he was cute, wasn't he?
Yes,
he was so a he was a little camel for those camels.
He was a little camel, yeah, real little camel. He definitely didn't get the size. He was he'd be about horse size almost.
Yeah, like regular horse size.
Yeah.
A second ago, we mentioned the word empathy, and when I first met you was at a horse expo in New Zealand, and the booth you were in was just a couple of booths down from ours, and you came over and said g'day, and you were doing some work for, who was that?
It was Kiwi Care Team.
That's what it was.
Yeah, so we went over to Egypt and India and did like animal welfare, like veterinary aid trips. And I loved it because you're on the streets of Cairo and there's the Sphinx and the pyramids right behind you. And, you know, there's camels, mules and donkeys coming in and you're trying to treat all these animals, you know, and obviously horrible conditions, but loved being able to do something positive about it. And probably first got introduced to camels there and was just amazed at how durable and tough and how well they healed and obviously how smart they were. And still part of that organization, we rebranded. We're now we work in the South Pacific. And we focus much, I guess, because we felt the South Pacific, we could have a long-term impact and really improve animals' lives for the better more permanently than we could in Egypt and India. And we're a Kiwi-based organization, so it makes sense to work in our own backyard. So now we do equine veterinary trips into Fiji. And we've been working with some villages for quite a few years now. And we used to go in and see, you know, horrific back wounds to the point where they're just raw meat and, you know, putrid and as bad as you can imagine, and probably worse than you can ever imagine. And we've been working with these villages now, and now we go into those same villages and it's not a single horse with a back wound. And now the horses aren't getting broken until they're 3 or 4, as opposed to being ridden as yearlings and 2-year-olds, because no one, you know, that's just what you did. Everyone was doing it. There's no other way. There's no, you know, it's not America, Australia, New Zealand. There's not access to outside knowledge. There's not anyone else doing it better. There's just only this one way that people do it in the villages. So, you know, you get these bad things happening, and we've been able to change things in some of those villages, and even castrating horses so that there's not a massive breeding problem, and just seeing such positive change in Fiji. Just love it. Love being a part of it. And I've always felt that, you know, horses have given me so much. You know, if it wasn't for horses, I wouldn't have gone to Mongolia. And I've gotten to compete at the top level because I have had amazing horses. So I've always felt that it is my duty to horse kind to give back in a way that I can, you know, and help them as much as, you know, they've made my life amazing. I owe it to them to try and help where I can. So that's kind of how I got involved in that. And I've just loved it, you know, seeing horrific things, especially in Egypt and India. I think it's beyond imagining how bad the situation can be. But have always loved being able to get in and get stuff done. And yeah, it was awesome to be able to be, you know, the client. You just wouldn't see it in our world, where you're like in a street clinic and you're just, there's camels on every side, there's horses on every side, there's donkeys on every side. You're like trying to like wrestle donkeys that, you know, you think are half dead, that they come up with so much strength and are suddenly walking on their back legs, you know, off towards the pyramids as you're trying to give them antibiotics or some such thing. Yeah, still very passionate about that kind of work. And again, it's really hard with COVID that we can't go to Fiji at the moment. But hopefully later this year or potentially next year, we'll be back on the ground there doing that.
You know, it must be a good feeling to get to the point, like say New Zealand, where you see that you're making a difference. You know, like in Cairo, yeah, you are basically a triage sort of thing. You just, you know, whatever comes in, you deal with it, but yeah, it's going to come back in again later. You know, the same problem's going to happen because of the same animal husbandry is going to be happening. But if you're seeing like a change in how people handle their animals and deal with their animals and look after their animals, that's got to feel, you know, that's kind of rewarding, whereas the other stuff's almost soul sucking a little bit.
Yeah, you know? It is. It's absolutely soul destroying when you know you're only helping there on the day. You know, long term hope for that animal is not great. Whereas Fiji, you just see it making a difference year by year. You see things improving. And I think the big thing with Fiji is it was definitely, you know, it was ignorance and there was no vets. There was no large animal vets in Fiji. And we've worked with their livestock officers and, you know, provided them with training to keep them safe on the job, because that was another thing, you know, that they don't have the ability to upskill that well over there. It's incredible. And I think India and Egypt, you're just a drop in the bucket and you're not going to have a big effect. And for many reasons, and also that the people, you know, human life is hard. It's hand to mouth daily struggle to survive, let alone kind of then have to try and improve your animal's life as well. And saying that, I've seen amazing animal welfare in those countries too, from the least likely sources, you know, people living in the brick factories making bricks and their mules were in beautiful condition and they'd be living in a shack made of brick seconds with a piece of corrugated tin on the roof, and their mule would be living in exactly the same size stable and being cared for to the best of their ability, even though they had little to nothing. Fiji, I love. It's just ongoing positive improvements there, and you see the horses and you kind of recognize the horses, and I think for the people, you know, and especially what might surprise people about Fiji is there's people in the interior of Fiji that rely on horses. You know, the midwife rides in on horseback, the nurse rides in on horseback to these remote villages. And the only way they get their goods to market is on horses. And yet some of these interior places in Fiji, they've never even seen the ocean. You know, that's how remote they are. And so I think if you can improve the horse's life, then you're kind of by default, you know, making it easier for the people too. Because if their horse lasts 10 years instead of 10 months, then it's less that they have to fork out to try and find a new horse, you know. So I think I really like that side of the animal welfare as well.
Wowzers. What an amazing life you've lived. So, you know, you've slowed down a bit because of the whole COVID thing, but when things back open back up, what's the adventurer's next adventure?
Well, I hope I can do the Great Nomad Expedition with all the four different animals in Mongolia and carry on with some of our adventures there. Definitely back to Australia with the dromedary camels. And then I think it's kind of getting to that time where I'd love to look for something new, something more. I'm not sure what that'll be. I think people always assume that I'm really restless or, you know, like constantly have FOMO or something. But actually I only ever do things that, you know, I believe that I feel really strongly about, you know, like Mongolia, I've always felt really strongly about and the welfare stuff. And yeah, I'd love to find something new to do that might test my skills and maybe give me some new skills. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but for now we'll do some yak back riding and camel riding and reindeer riding in Mongolia.
Yak back riding. Okay, so we've got to the question portion of our conversation here. Oh yeah, the time has got away from me. Normally I can whip these in the middle of the conversation, but anyway, we're just going to do it like one after another here. So as everybody knows, I give my guests 20 questions and they get to choose a few of them that they want to talk a little bit about. And Chloe's first one is, what book do you recommend the most? Not necessarily your favorite book to read, but one you feel everyone needs to read.
Endurance, about the Shackleton expedition to the South Pole. Just, I think, a great story of what humans are capable of when things go completely wrong.
Why am I not surprised? Okay, what's the most worthwhile thing that you've ever put your time into? Something that has changed the course of your life?
I think working with the wild horses. I think wild horses led to so many other expeditions or so many other avenues. And I think, you know, in all the years that I've been working with them, I think me and a few other people have really raised their profile here in New Zealand. And you know, we're seeing many more people take them on and save them, and new competitions arise from it. So yeah, I think working with the wild horses has been something that I have loved and changed the course of my life and something I'm really proud to have done.
This next question may be along the same lines. What accomplishment are you most proud of?
I think the Derby is something that no one can take away from me. It was just something, by the time I'd done it, I was really proud of what I'd done in myself. And I think, you know, I've done a lot of competitive horse riding, but that's also results-based. Like, you're not happy unless you've won, and you're always striving for the next big win. Whereas the Mongol Derby, I gave it absolutely everything. I don't think I could have given it any more. I got out of it what I wanted. So I think the Mongol Derby and probably doing the first winter camel expedition, because everyone thought it was a crazy idea and I was kind of secretly backing it that it was a good idea, and just having pulled that off was a really good feeling.
Yeah, that must have been amazing. Like, you know, by the time I went, you guys knew what you were doing. You'd done it before three times or twice before.
Yeah.
And that first one was the coldest one too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yep, that one got to negative 45 and some cows and goats froze to death outside our gur that we were sleeping in.
It's pretty cold. So this is an interesting question because the next question. In the last 5 years, what have you become better at saying no to?
Free horses.
That was pretty quick. Didn't even think
I think, you know, I used to like, because I guess I started off like working with problem horses and used to feel like I should, like if people offered me a horse, like I should just be grateful for the work and say yes to every single horse. And then, you know, people have always gifted me horses and I'm pretty good at, well, not always, but I'm pretty good at saying no to being given free problem horses these days. So yeah, I've got other things to do. And so I've gotten better. Not 100%, but I'm pretty good at saying no to free horses or people wanting to freeload.
That's the first time I've got that answer to that question. That's not the first time I've asked that question on the podcast, but that's the first time free horses has been the answer. what quality do you admire most in a person?
I think honesty and integrity. And I think honesty in a way that, you know, people can say that they're struggling when they really are, or being honest about their experience. I think having crossed paths with some pretty big egos, I really, really value integrity and humility and honesty. And I think the three kind of all go hand in hand. And yeah, I think I really appreciate it. And I appreciate it in horse trainers, you know, like I really like it, you know, sitting down with a bunch of professionals and we can all be, you know, really honest and say, hey, you know, like what's working for you, what's not, rather than, yeah, I think maybe 10 years ago, you know, people being like, oh no, I'm the best with every single horse I come across. Whereas now, you know, I really value trainers that will sit there and, you know, troubleshoot, and I value expedition people and adventure people who are really, really honest about their successes and failures and honest about how they actually went about achieving it. I really, yeah. And humility and being humble, I think are stuff that I really, really value. And I don't mind hearing that people are struggling or that, you know, anything like that. Like I really admire the courage to come out and say that, you know, this is where I struggle, this is where I'm good, all that kind of thing, I think is really great skill in people.
Very good. And this next question, I have not had a podcast guest who has failed to choose this question. Everybody's chosen this question. And I think this is the perfect question for you, seeing your book is called Fearless. What is your relationship like with fear?
So I'm not fearless. There's definitely things that scare me. I think I try to break it down into being, is it a logical fear? And what are the steps? Like, is it, you know, like what can I do to prevent that fear? Like, you know, getting in the start box at a big cross country. Like if you're not afraid, you shouldn't be there because those jumps are massive. But I know that that fear is just an emotion, and then I put all the homework into my horse, and I trust my horse, and I'm not going in that start box without knowing that my horse has every single skill and tool in the box to get me over those jumps. And I think the same with expeditions, you know, like, yeah, like going out into negative 45 for the first time, like there's no way you're not scared. Like, again, if you're not scared, then you're probably foolhardy and, you know, an accident's coming your way. So I try, if I have fear, to you know, go through all the mental preparation and have, you know, problem solved in my mind what will happen in every situation. And I think that's my way of dealing with fear, is trying to be very logical about it. I think I do try to play things pretty close to my chest. Like I don't openly show it. But yeah, I just try to go about it in the logical way, and not kind of buy too much into the emotion of it and read too much into it.
You know, one of my podcast guests said something really cool about this. She said, you know, well, there's two types of fear. There's the fear you should listen to and the fear that you shouldn't listen to.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
And I thought it was a great way of putting it. Like, some things you shouldn't be afraid of.
Yeah.
Some fears that come up, like they're just BS fears. But there's some things you should be scared of, and you shouldn't do that thing. And it's, I think it's being able to differentiate between the two. And a lot of people I see around horses get them totally backwards. They're not afraid of the things they should be afraid of, and then they're afraid of the things that they shouldn't be afraid of, you know. So
I agree with that too. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
You see that quite a bit. So there's all your questions for you. So Chloe, it has been such a pleasure to have you on here and have a good chat again. You're such an inspiration. I think, you know, you not just doing what you do, but being public about it and letting people know what you're doing. You know, you're such an inspiration for, hell, 53-year-old people, men like me, but I'm really think you're such an inspiration for young girls. Like you, you're like the walking example of you can do anything you put your mind to. And I think that's such an amazing gift that you just bring to the world, and thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really nice to hear. And I think, yeah, if there's anything to take away from this, you know, like I've never been set up. It's always been hard to make these things happen, but they're totally achievable. And, you know, to me, it just feels like everyday life these days, you know, like, of course you go and do these expeditions. Like, why wouldn't you? Or, you know, yeah. Yeah. So that's really nice to hear. I hope it does make it seem achievable for the next generation and people coming after me. Like I always tell the kids on horse camp that I hope that, like, you know, when I'm no longer doing this, they're going out and doing cool stuff and they can come back and tell me and get my adventure fixed that way.
You know, I think you guys, you and like the Wilson sisters and stuff are just inspiring. I can't wait to see what the next generation of, because, you know, you guys just started doing this stuff on your own when you were young, but this, you're inspiring. It's kind of like the internet. You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know you could do two backflips on a motorbike, so no one ever thought of doing it, you know. But these days, you can see everything's possible, and then you can go out and try it. And I just think it's exciting to see, like, say, the girls that come to your camps, you know, kids just getting inspired so early on. Oh, speaking of the Wilson sisters, we've got one more crazy story I need to tell before we finish up. So a few years ago now on New Year's Day, you guys decided, hey, it's New Year's Day, let's do something fun. What did you guys do?
Well, most recently we just have been galloping around chasing.
No. It had to do with, I think that it was a yellow coloured aeroplane.
Okay. I mean, it wasn't on New Year's Day exactly, but it was around New Year's time. So we thought that wing walking on, you know, those old, what are they called? Tiger moths? No, I can't remember what they're, but you know, like the planes that are basically made of balsa wood.
Yeah, it's a biplane, isn't it?
Biplane, that's the one. So we found like the kind of the last pilot in New Zealand that flies one of these planes, and his wife used to be a wing walker for like air shows and things. And so a handful of us were like, this sounds like something cool to do. So we rocked up to this airstrip in the middle of some farmland, and one by one got on the plane, strapped this like tiny little harness on top of the wings, and the plane would take off and you'd start flying a lap, and yeah, you'd be standing up on top of the plane, arms out. Yeah, it was amazing. It was absolutely incredible. I wouldn't repeat the experience in a hurry, but it was really exhilarating. And I think the only really scary thing to me is like those planes don't go as fast as you think. So it does have this like little bit of feeling like you may fall out of the sky at any moment. But still to be up there in the air, you know, very tentatively attached to a plane was a pretty, pretty incredible experience. And we've had a few cool adventures like that together.
You know, that's a great little snapshot of what Chloe's life is like. I said, so you did something a little crazy a few years ago on New Year's Day. What was it? And she couldn't actually come up with she couldn't remember the fact that they strapped themselves to the top of a balsa wood plane while it took off and flew around the sky. I kind of had to prompt that out of her. So that gives you an idea of what the crazy life that Chloe Phillips Harris leads. So, Chloe, if people want to know more about you or maybe about the Cold Camel Expedition or the what's the other one?
The Great Nomad Expedition.
And Big Blue Flower in general. How do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, so the best way is for the Great Nomad Expedition, you can just Google it or dub the Great Nomad Expedition. Otherwise on Facebook for the Great Nomad Expedition or all of our other expeditions and adventures and things, you just look up Chloe Phillips Harris Adventurer and you can find me. And actually I've got one more New Zealand based adventure coming up. And if people look up Born to Run Adventure Racing, we have our newest New Zealand based one for any New Zealander listeners out there that also involves animals and some some wild country.
Sounds exciting. So, well, we better wrap it up here. But Chloe, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Like I said, it's so good to talk to you again, but it's so good to share your story with people, because you're quite an inspiration to everybody you've ever met. And hopefully through the podcast, you might be a little bit of an inspiration to a few more people.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great talking to you again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's just been so much fun. So thank you, Chloe, and you guys all at home listening. Thanks for joining us on the Journey On podcast, and we will catch you on the next edition of it.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.